Rewind, your week in review is sponsored by the Wisconsin Realtors Association, bringing Wisconsin communities to life with great homes, businesses, and neighborhoods. The Wisconsin Realtors Association, the voice of real estate.
This week on Rewind, your week in review, Governor Tony Evers said vetoing the entire biennial budget is, quote, on the table after lawmakers approved a $128 million increase in K-12 spending. The Joint Finance Committee signed off on extra funding to help some individuals find jobs amid the state's worker shortage. And the flurry of committee activity continued this week as lawmakers held hearings on bills surrounding so-called vaccine passports, policing, and redistricting. Rewind, your week in review for June 4th.
I'm Brianna Riley.
And I'm J.R. Ross.
This week, Governor Tony Evers indicated a full veto of the biennial state budget is, quote, on the table after lawmakers on the Joint Finance Committee last week invested just $128 million more in K-12 education. Lawmakers last week also voted to transfer $350 million to the Budget Stabilization Fund for education purposes in future years. Evers called that investment, quote, paltry and an insult to the kids of our state. Meanwhile, the U.S. Department of Education last week warned the transfer wouldn't count toward the requirement to qualify for federal school aid under two COVID relief packages. That includes the American Rescue Plan Act, which was passed under the Biden administration a few months ago. Under that, those requirements, states going forward have to maintain the proportion of K-12 spending they logged in fiscal years 2016-17 through 2017-18 to get the money. Evers said he's asking lawmakers to invest more in K-12. Asked about Evers' comments and the letter by one J.R. Ross, co-chairs Howard Markline and Mark Boren told reporters neither gave them pause surrounding the panel's actions last week. Bit of a deja vu moment this week for me, J.R. 2 years ago, Evers also left open the possibility of vetoing the entire state budget. Of course, he ultimately did not do that. Instead, he did 78 partial vetoes. All the Democrats in the legislature ended up voting against the document. Of course, we've got a little bit different of a situation this time around. How seriously do you take the possibility of an entire budget veto this time around?
Well, in talking to people this week, the impression I got was that the chance is better than it was a week and a day ago. But still, the question is, what's the upside for Evers if he vetoes the entire budget? So remember a couple things. One, this document's not done yet. They're going to do transportation next week. If they put more money into roads, locals will want it. The governor signed the budget. They haven't done health services yet. They put more money into Medicaid, into hospitals and nursing homes. They'll want the governor to sign the budget. So there will be pressure from other groups that are going to see things from finance yet that might encourage them to sign the budget. On the education front, too, remember, Republican argument is you can't look at that state money in a vacuum. There is so much federal money coming in through the various COVID packages that that has to be taken into account. If the governor vetoes the entire budget, there won't be an increase for mental health education, or sorry, for mental health funding in the budget. No more state money for that. There'll still be the federal money. And one of the theories was that Republicans would want governor to sign a budget because they wouldn't want to not have their schools get more money because they were in person. And we're kind of generalizing, you know, but mostly the schools in Republican districts were in person for in-person instruction a lot of this year. Well, remember, part of the package did last week with that small increase of state tax dollars, they were reworked a federal pot of money to make sure that districts that were in person at least 50% of the 2021 school year would get on average $781 per kid. Those are mostly Republican districts. That's a lot of money per child compared to a state increase. So they feel like there's no pressure on them if the governor vetoes the budget. They're not going to do another one. So what's the upside for Evers by vetoing a budget? Now, the upside could be he vetoes it, he runs against Republicans and says, look, there's this do-nothing legislature. They won't work with me. They won't expand Medicaid. They won't put money into schools. They won't do legalize marijuana. These guys are not where the public is. That doesn't get these groups who have things in the budget they want anything in the next year and a half. So there is that pressure that, like I said, the chances may be better than they were before, but it's not quite clear the upside beyond unless the governor wants to go campaign against, like make this part of the campaign of, they didn't do what I wanted to do. You like my policies, voters. Therefore, you should vote them out of the legislature to make my policies a possibility.
Yeah, and let's step back and sort of look at the context of the timeline here, too. Co-chair Mark Boren said this week that the Joint Finance Committee is looking at wrapping up its work by the end of the month and sending the budget to the legislature for votes. We obviously, going forward, we'll see continued committee action Tuesdays and Thursdays, right?
Yep.
Until they're all done at the Joint Finance level. We're expecting a big tax cut as well, in addition to, of course, the other budget areas of action that you mentioned that we're waiting on. We're still waiting on revenue estimates, aren't we, or re-estimates?
Yep.
What else are you watching for in the coming weeks?
So that Medicaid budget, so the vibe that I've kind of picked up is that a lot of the talk is like, what can they do for nursing homes, for example? There's a certified nursing assistant shortage in Wisconsin, like a lot of occupations, it's hard to fill that job. They want to find help for those folks. Transportation is going to be a big one to see what happens this week. Stewardship is a big thing. It's still on the to-do list. Broadband, it's on the to-do list. But the reality is that a lot of things, they're not doing big increases in state money, right? They're doing little bits and pieces here and there. Like this week, they did some job training stuff, but not everything that Governor Evers wanted. They didn't spend as much money as he's proposing. It's a theme through each agency of no policy, no big spending increases, and kind of like reordering money to their priorities. So it seems like there's definitely a way to be done with this budget by month's end, and even like on the governor's desk before July 4th weekend.
The other thing that we didn't mention that's happening on Tuesday is the capital budget, too, which, again, you know, lawmakers on the Building Commission deadlocks on every single project. So we'll see maybe a repeat of what happened last year in finance. What are you expecting in terms of overall dollar figures?
A significant dial back. Mm-hmm. So the governor's about $2.4 billion. I think it's close to $2 billion in new bonding. $1 billion of the overall package is for UW system. I would expect it to be not cut in half, maybe, but I think there's going to be debate about it's the first number should probably be a 1 point, but I don't know what's going to be after that one. That's what I'm trying to figure out right now.
There you go. We'll watch for that next week. But now let's turn to hear more about this potential budget veto. We'll hear from Evers first on his K-12 spending plan, followed by his response to a question from you, JR. And then we'll hear from JFC co-chairs Mark Boren and Howard Markline and their brief answer to yet another question from you, JR.
I'm nosy.
Well, of course, I'm asking them to invest more. What they invested was paltry and an insult to the kids of our state. Not only should they be meeting the requirements of the federal government, they should be actually helping our kids move forward as a state. There are adequate resources. We've said this every single day. My budget was a reasonable approach. What the Republicans have put forward is not only inadequate, but even if they meet those federal guidelines, it's an inadequate response.
Governor, back to Clay Pro funding, if they fail to put up money in the qualify for the federal dollars, would you veto this budget?
That's too early to tell, but that is always an option that is on the table.
Governor yesterday said that a veto is on the table over the budget in general because of the called a paltry investment in K-12. On Friday, a letter was sent from education saying that the amount of money put in doesn't meet the requirement of effort to get federal money. Does that give you any pause about what you guys did last week with K-12? How much money is in there from the state?
No. Nope, nothing's really changed since last week. We're still working through the budget process.
Okay. The Joint Finance Committee approved workforce development and natural resources measures in their budget votes this week. Lawmakers signed off on a GOP motion to up funds to help those with disabilities find jobs and allow more veterans to qualify for workforce measures. They also voted to fund a study to make changes to the state's unemployment insurance system without the $15 million more Governor Evers wanted to fund the system. And their motion included a measure to direct DWD to issue a rule to implement a drug testing requirement for the state's UI program. They also voted to scrap a series of proposals from Governor Evers to help Wisconsinites get jobs. Separately, lawmakers voted to buy body cameras for DNR wardens, bolster ATV and UTV trail maintenance efforts, increase the cost of the waterfowl stamp by $5, and more. We're continuing to hear a lot about the worker shortage, JR. Separate from the Joint Finance Committee, Assembly Speaker Robin Voss told a gathering of WMC folks, the Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce, this week that the state could do more to tighten unemployment rules and withhold benefits from those who are looking for work but fail to show up for job interviews. Meanwhile, there's still continued calls to target that $300 extra in weekly federal unemployment benefits that the state is getting. Do you expect a focus on these worker shortage efforts to continue in the weeks ahead? I know that we've talked. I don't know if you want to touch this area, but I'm already hearing some chatter from folks that this is going to be a big campaign issue in 2022. Tell me why that might be a little premature at this point.
So we got new jobs numbers today from the federal government, 560,000 roughly jobs created, short of the 650,000 some were predicting. Last month's report fell well short of the million jobs some talked about. So that's part of this theme of trying to push back against the president's COVID-19 efforts, the stimulus package that's not doing it correctly. It's causing this worker shortage. The governor's answer has been repeatedly that we had a worker issue even before the pandemic. This is not because of the pandemic. The $300 a week is not preventing people from going back to work. There are other factors at play. You know, I mean, we're sitting here in June of 2021. The election's a long way away. I don't know if it's going to be a dominant theme come next fall. It just depends on how things pick up, you know. But Republicans see this package is mostly popular with the public, right? And, you know, they got big checks, a lot of people, so of course it's going to be popular. They like seeing those things. They're looking at ways of trying to undercut that support, and this is one of them. And we just got to wait and see how that job picture develops. I mean, I saw a graph today. We're still like $6.7 million jobs short of where we were pre-pandemic a year and a half ago. So there's still ground to make up. It's a question of, are some of those people who aren't back in the workforce, have they given up? They said, you know what, I'm near retirement age. I don't want to go back. I mean, there are all kinds of things you don't know about why people aren't back in the workforce yet with all these jobs that are available.
Yeah, and this issue was definitely discussed during Joint Finance this week. Senator LaTanya Johnson and co-chair Mark Bourne had a back and forth about this. They discussed UI and unemployment during Wednesday's executive session. Let's hear from them.
When you have individuals who are barely making ends meet, they're surviving paycheck to paycheck. And on top of them being able to survive paycheck to paycheck, they lose their job. And now they're thrust into not knowing how they're going to pay their rent. And they're depending on an antiquated, outdated UI system to do that for them. This system wasn't just faulty with the Evers administration. It's been faulty for years. And, you know, making unemployment more difficult for people to get was supposed to be the purpose of the system.
From my perspective, it seems like the other side is focused on, with an agency that's called Workforce Development, ways to make it harder to do business in Wisconsin with a lot of the programs that you mentioned. And ways to keep people on welfare programs, to keep them out of the workforce. How can we expand these programs, make them bigger and more money and more interest? And yes, that is certainly the direct opposite of what we think should be done. I mean, we understand that these programs are necessary to give people a helping hand, but the helping hand should be over. I mean, there are large sectors desperate for workers. And workforce development needs to start developing that workforce and focusing on how we get people back in. Worrying about how we can get more money out the door on unemployment insurance should not be the priority anymore.
La Crosse County District Attorney will not press charges over potential voter fraud. Background here that we didn't touch on last week is the Wisconsin Elections Commission had identified 41 instances of potential voter fraud since late August 2020 in that report last week. Of those, more than half of those instances flagged were tied to La Crosse County. There, 22 people had registered to vote with a UPS store address. The DA there said 16 of the 22 improper addresses voted in 2020, but his investigation found no intent to break the law. according to WisPolitics.com. The commission's report also listed referrals in Milwaukee, Brown, St. Croix, Langlade, Columbia, Jackson, and Waukesha counties. The more than three dozen instances of voter fraud identified, I should note, are a fraction of the ballots cast since August. For example, in November, some 3.3 million Wisconsinites voted. This week also, the Wisconsin Elections Commission voted to send a report listing those instances of suspected fraud as reported by local clerks to the legislature, which is, you know, mandated under state law. It's also worth noting additional allegations of suspected fraud could be flagged in future reports, including through our participation in ERIC going forward. Anything else to add on this, JR? Are you surprised not to see charges?
No. Every 2 years, we get a report from Elections Commission. Every 2 years, I call the DAs, or one of my coworkers calls the DAs to ask what's going on, and they say, this person made an honest mistake, or this person did this. In the La Crosse County instance, those 16 people, they use that address to forward their mail to them at their snowbirds. So they go down to Florida or wherever for warmer weather in the wintertime, and they just use that address for whatever reason. There was an intent to commit voter fraud. They have an actual address in the area where they live, and so he said, no harm, no foul. We've had instances where people have thought their absentee ballot wouldn't get in there on time, so they went down to vote in person. And the absentee ballot likely was received after the deadline, so therefore it kind of didn't, I mean, I'll say it didn't matter, but in the end, the person was probably right. The ballot didn't get there until after Tuesday, so that vote wasn't counted. That's the issue with all these cases, is there wasn't intent to commit fraud. Also worth noting that all these bills that we're seeing from legislature, from Republicans, not a single one would address any of the issues of actual potential fraud we saw in November. That's because you can't stop this kind of fraud. You can't, unless you have an electronic poll book at every polling site in Wisconsin that is updated every instance with whose vote is in, whether somebody is still a felon, things like that, you can't possibly catch this stuff. It's just, it is a post-election audit situation every time. So it's just kind of a worth noting with all these bills floating around, they don't address the stuff we see. And fraud is an issue. Let's not, you know, diminish it. It is a small issue every election, and it happens every single election I've covered. There's an instance like that of somebody who voted twice. Somebody who lives, has a cabin in Montana and a residence here and votes in both places. I mean, it happens. And it's not right, but it's in a very small number of the 3 million plus people who voted last fall.
And we talked about those election bills in recent weeks, but there's also a flurry of other bills that are being considered by committees in terms of ongoing, very intense committee activity leading into a very busy floor period month in June. So let's move on to talk about some of the bills that got hearings this week. For example, lawmakers held a bill on a fast moving bill to delay the redistricting process for county board and local aldermanic races. Other committees voted to approve legislation to make it a felony to recklessly handle a vaccine, ban the use of chokeholds except in certain situations, and overhaul other police procedures. Of course, lawmakers also heard testimony on a series of bills seeking to prevent companies, the state, or other entities from requiring individuals from showing proof they've received the COVID-19 vaccine. Another bill, there were four of those first bills, this fifth bill would bar the UW system and tech colleges from requiring students to be tested for COVID-19 or vaccinated against the virus. No one spoke against the bills in the very lengthy hearing on Wednesday, but we'll hear from a couple supporters of the UW vaccine bill in a second. Some opponents did submit written testimony, though, ahead of the hearing. That includes the Wisconsin Medical Society. Chief Policy and Advocacy Officer Mark Grapenstein wrote, regular testing for COVID-19 helps prevent the virus from spreading in crowded classrooms while also incentivizing vaccinations, which are effective in slowing further spread. He later went on to add, smart strategies that protect students and staff while creating a safe environment, allowing colleges to return to in-person learning should not be hindered. The UW system also submitted testimony as well. The Associate Vice President for Government Relations wrote that the bill could, quote, severely jeopardize UWS's ability to sustain in-person learning this fall. He added that that would happen by limiting the ability to use testing that, quote, protects the health and safety of students in congregate settings. He also noted the system isn't planning to mandate vaccines this fall when students return. Let's hear now, before we dive into a discussion about all of these bills and more, from supporters of this UW bill to bar testing and vaccination requirements at system schools.
I don't see how mandating testing by any means lowers positive numbers. Testing, as far as I'm aware, is just an indicator of positive results of COVID coming and going. And we found the spikes without the mandate last fall when the testing was not mandated. Now, if I do not comply with these tests or vaccine requirements, I am deemed quote-unquote dangerous by my university. My university is essentially making the possibility of getting a virus punishable by suspension or expulsion. And under this policy, students are assumed sick until proven healthy.
This has been very passionate for me. My son, Trenton Kerbs, he was a freshman at Whitewater. We had to pay full tuition, full room and board, for him to be isolated in his room. He had that testing swab stuck up his nose at least 15 times. It is invasive, and you're going to tell me that you don't know what the long-term effects of that is? Opening your body up to infection or viruses or anything else to get up in there? This is horrible. And if my son has to go through that again, he will not be getting the vaccine. He will not be going to the UW system. And for the UW-Madison people, three times a week, they don't have symptoms. They're not ill. What is the purpose of this?
There are a ton of bills getting hearings this week. I guess other bills that I didn't mention that received public press conferences as they were introduced include three from Republicans to ban quote-unquote critical race theory in classrooms, and then another dozen bills from Democratic lawmakers targeting policing practices sort of as a response and additional, I guess, measures that the task force didn't consider in their report. We've got floor periods coming up this month. We've got a session that will run late into the fall, it seems like. What do you expect to sort of be the theme of legislation that will be taken up in the weeks to come?
Well, I hear it's going to be a busy June, in part because the election bills, for example, Republican State Convention is end of June. I think there's some lawmakers who like to get some of those bills done and on the governor's desk to be vetoed before they go off to state convention. This fall, there's a resolution on the assembly calendar for Wednesday that would expand the floor period. So lawmakers actually have set days they can meet. They set a calendar at the end of every two-year session. They're actually going to add two more weeks in October. I'm not quite sure what they plan to take up just yet. I've asked a couple people, like, oh, we just may need some more time. It might avoid some marathon session days, I guess, in October, September, and November. But we are going to have a full October of floor action, at least in the assembly, I think. There's maybe a little more pent-up energy to do some bills there than the Senate right now. We'll see. But I think there's a long list of bills Republicans want to get done. What's interesting is 2 years ago, kind of the sentiment was among Republicans, well, why do certain bills? Because Evers is going to veto them. So let's just not even put forth the effort. I get the impression there's a different kind of attitude now of let's go ahead and get it on his desk, let him veto it because of election next year. A little different dynamic, right? And there's a GOP base that is kind of like demanding certain things because they were disappointed in how Republicans responded to COVID-19. They didn't try and take on Evers' mask mandate, for example, before the election last year. They want to see more action on certain things, and this might be part of that response to that kind of cry from the base.
Sort of on the flip side of that, I've heard some questions from folks, I guess, throughout Governor Evers' first term in office, but especially in recent weeks, about why the governor isn't more vocal about whether he will veto bills that, you know, certainly seem like they're destined for an Evers veto. We sort of saw some of that commentary this week, for example, in this press conference at the Capitol, where he was asked about these vaccine bills, and he sort of demurred and didn't exactly commit to vetoing them, but did his sort of standard, you know, I'll take a look at them. What is the strategy there, especially as we're seeing more and more, I guess, veto bait bills coming his way?
Most governors I've covered kind of leave themselves some wiggle room just in case, because, you know, you never know how the bill's going to change. How it plays out in the end, if you can get some changes made to it, make it more to your liking, things like that. So a lot of them kind of give themselves just a little bit of space. Scott Walker did the same exact thing. Even bills he really liked, well, not every time, but some bills even that we thought for sure he was going to sign, he'd say he'd wait and see what happened. So,
yep, just standard practice for governors. All right, let's move on to stocks this week. What's rising, JR?
So the Evers campaign. So look, the governor, all indications mean he's going to run for election in 2022. He finished last year with more than $3 million in the bank. Now, you don't do that just for the heck of it. Granted, a lot of it was a transfer from the Democratic Party of Wisconsin or transfers. But now we've got four senior staffers he's hired for his campaign. Didn't officially announce he's running, but it's clear he's gearing up toward that. Now, as he's gearing up, we have a Republican field that is still taking shape. We have Rebecca Clayfish, who's all but in base. She's just waiting to make the announcement, right? She's got a PAC. She's got this issue advocacy group that she's working with. She's got infrastructure in place. Bill McCoshin, a lobbyist, he's, we think, moving toward a run, but we're not quite sure that he's there. A lot of other people are talking about it. I mean, the list of names is fairly long. You know, Eric Hovde, a Madison businessman, Kevin Nicholson, who ran for Senate in 2018. He's looking at Senate and governor. Mike Gallagher's name gets mentioned. Sean Duffy's name gets mentioned, and, you know, a couple of people. There's a big difference between thinking about it and actually launching a campaign. And Clayfish is out ahead of the pack in terms of getting organized. Now, for Evers, the next question is, what do you run on? So he can run on saying the Republicans wouldn't expand Medicaid. They wouldn't fund education the way I wanted to. You know, they're the impediment to all these things that you guys want to have happen, voters. But there's got to be something more, you know, some forward-looking vision. That's what people are watching for the governor, is what's going to be his forward-looking vision, because it can't just be, well, these guys are didn't do what I want them to do. His vulnerabilities are going to be the unemployment insurance issue. I mean, that's not good with the number of people waited for checks. The ads write themselves. The violent protests in Kenosha, that's going to be a problem for him. And then, you know, having the party in power in the White House be the same as yours, that's always a challenge for governors in Wisconsin. The party, so Democrats, Democratic wave in 2018, Republican in the White House. Republican wave in 2014, Democrat in the White House. Republican wave 2010, Democrat in the White House. Dem wave in 2006, Republican in the White House. I mean, like, it's just been a pattern. So how do you overcome that? Now, it's also a post-pandemic election. I have never covered one of those. I hope to never cover one again. Be quite honest, I don't know how that's going to impact things, but there are a lot of unknowns. And speaking of the pandemic, the governor's handling of COVID-19 will be probably a big part of his reelection strategy, or the argument against him. The people came to these vaccine hearings, they are fired up about vaccines and mask mandates, all this stuff. There's a group of people who are very motivated to vote against Governor Evers next fall because of it. And so we just got to see how things shake out. But that's the lay of the land right now as we sit here a year and a half out from his reelection.
Yeah, no candidates officially in the race, Dan, I guess, technically. Do you expect those official announcements to come later this summer still?
I think once the budget passes, you'll start to see the dam break on things, and then it's going to really start to move.
Mm-hmm. All right, what's mixed this week?
So Tommy Thompson, look, with the UW budget, we talked a little bit last week. The tuition freeze is set to go away, but the tech college system got more than UW and GPR. And one of the questions within this budget was, okay, Republicans have been hesitant to give money to the UW system because they don't trust it. It's a liberal institution, you know, the ivory tower thing, et cetera, et cetera. The argument was Tommy Thompson get a better deal than anybody else because he's one of them. This budget kind of proves, no matter if it was Tommy Thompson, Paul Ryan, Scott Walker, even Donald Trump as president of the UW system, some Republicans are just not going to give money to the UW system, especially with the federal money coming in. Now, there are still challenges coming up. One of them is his capital budget. $1 billion of that was for UW. Will he get a good deal out of that final package that Republicans approve? And also, you know, while Tommy needed a big boost from the Republicans, argument could be made if it wasn't for him, it would have gotten a worse deal. So remember, lapses are when basically the state says you have to give back money we gave you already. So UW had a lapse, I think like $86 million in that ballpark through all this stuff. The lapse wasn't made permanent in the budget the Republicans are working on the Joint Finance Committee. What that means is, so their base budget going the next budget, it's not going to account for that lapse. The level stays the same, essentially. It sounds like not much, but it means you're not funding for lost ground just to get back to where you were before in that next budget. So that kind of helps the system, right? Other thing is, this tuition freeze going away, big thing to watch is what the regions do with it. Because the Republicans have been looking for a way to get back that power to the regions for a while. They wanted to figure out how to do it, and should there be guardrails? Well, now it's a board made up of mostly Evers appointees. If they jack it up by 10%, the argument is the Republicans can blame it on the governor. These are his people. We froze this for 10 years. He comes in the door, and all of a sudden now you've got this big increase in tuition. So they feel like now is the time to pass it off, and then if something goes awry, they can blame it on somebody else.
That's right. And what's falling this week, J.R.?
So COVID. I mean, it's interesting. The Wisconsin Hospital Association has been tracking hospitalizations for COVID since April of 2020. Hit our lowest number on Monday since it began. New cases are down. Vaccinations are up. And yet you're seeing this kind of renewed push for COVID bills. We talked a little bit ago with, you know, vaccine passports, banning mandatory vaccines, discrimination about your vaccination status, banning vaccines for UB students. There is a segment of the Republican base that is COVID fatigued and wants to get like its pushback. You know, they're sensing it. They're fired up. Now, the question is, what Republicans do? Will they pass all these bills? One of them, the vaccine passport, quite frankly, that's taken off in other states, so that one might have its best shot. The others, we'll have to see if there's a passion in both houses to do it. But again, there's a segment of the Republican base that is unhappy about how the COVID fight went last year because they felt like there was too many restrictions. Republicans didn't do enough to try and shield them from these onerous government regulations, and now they want to see the fight taken to Governor Evers and Democrats about this issue.
We'll keep an eye on that in the weeks ahead. Thanks, JR, and thanks everyone for tuning in. I'm Brianna Riley.
And I'm JR Ross.
And keep an eye out for Wisconsinized coverage of the State Democratic Party convention this weekend. That's Rewind for June 4th.
Rewind, your week in review, is sponsored by the Wisconsin Realtors Association, bringing Wisconsin communities to life with great homes, businesses, and neighborhoods. The Wisconsin Realtors Association, the voice of real estate.